Welcome to the Watchmen podcast, part of the DC TV podcast network and your place for everything Watchmen, including the new HBO TV series. And today we're going to talk a little bit more about comics. We're going to focus mostly on Rorschach and the Comedian. But then I'm going to start off a little bit with, you know, how Alan Moore got from, you know, where he was on Swamp Thing over to Watchmen, what led to the Watchmen and how we got there, and then kind of open it up to some talk about where the inspiration came for the characters.
It's a really exciting thing, guys. Like, honestly, Alan Moore is a fascinating dude.
So I'm not going to give you Alan Moore's whole history, because we did do that back in Swamp Thing, with a more, you know, geared towards understanding how he got to Swamp Thing, which was kind of his big break into the mainstream books. He did a lot of things over in England, and one of which we'll talk about. But what, you know, Swamp Thing was what kind of put him on the map in America, and kind of how he got into that space. Now, so Alan Moore, a lot of people try to tie back, you know, where did the impetus for Watchmen come from, to the issue of Swamp Thing, where the Justice League are featured, and there's the line, "There's a house above the world where the Uber people dwell," and you kind of see what in reality what the Justice League would look like from a person in our world's point of view. But he kind of insists that that was more trying to show Justice League in a horror genre, and really his drive for doing the Watchmen started because of a book he did called Miracle Man. And Miracle Man kind of came about because of a distribution problem. So
let's be clear. Who is Miracle Man? Because there are multiple Miracle Mans, at least the month.
Oh, yeah. Alan Moore's Miracle Man was a series in the 80s. So what had happened was, there had been a thing in the 60s that was about, it was like a ripoff of Shazam. And Alan Moore said, they asked Alan Moore to write it because they need a high profile guy to write it. And he's like, "Well, I'm going to write it, but you have to let me do some interesting things with it, because I'm not just going to write Shazam," because he had some ideas. And what he ended up doing was taking what is one of the most, how do I say, pure characters.
Yeah, like very, like, uplifting and all that.
In DC Comics and Fawcett Comics before that, but you know, what is one of the most, you know, pure characters, and kind innocent of really twisting it. Yes. What if this was the real world? What if Captain Marvel had amnesia, and one day he woke up and realized who he was? And then what if that power, you know, was really just dangerous? It's like a nuclear bomb going off every time he used it. So, and there's nudity, there's adult themes. It's a very interesting story with incredible artwork. And I do kind of, you know, if you can find it was very hard to find for a long time. But if you're able to find it and read it, I do recommend it. But he had played with themes in there as well. And I think one of the things we talked about in Swamp Thing was his desire to really recognize that the comic book fans that had been kids in the Silver Age were now adults. And if the comics industry was going to keep them on, it would have to mature the product, because they still wanted to buy comic books, but, you know, the stories had to grow up. Now, granted, in the 70s, they were already starting to grow up, and we can talk about that in another time, but, you know, he didn't single-handedly bring comics into a media as a medium for adults, but he did take it places where comics had been unwilling to go before, you know, dealing with real themes, dealing with, you know, real-world problems. Now, he had in his mind this idea of what he wanted to do, that he wanted to do a comic book that took major characters and brought them into a real world setting. And it was just an idea. He kind of had an idea that it would start with a murder mystery, and he kind of had an idea where he wanted to go. And then suddenly he had an opportunity where the Charlton Comic Book Company was purchased by DC. And all of their characters came in together, and they were trying to figure out how to incorporate them into their stories, or what to do with them now that they own the rights to all of these characters. Now, Charlton Comics includes some characters that you know, like the Blue Beetle and the Question. And some other characters that you might not know, like Thunderbolt and Peacemaker, although some of you may know Peacemaker, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Nightshade. And we'll talk about that next podcast. But there were a lot of Charlton, so they brought them over. And so he thought, wow, we now have the rights to all these Charlton comics. Why don't I take that entire universe and kind of update them, put a fresh spin on them, and like show them as, you know, this is what if the Charlton comics characters existed in the real world. So initially, when he wrote the full pitch for the full story, he wrote it as with featuring the Charlton comics characters. And then they decided maybe they didn't want to use the Charlton comics characters because, you know, once you do Watchmen, those characters aren't really coming back. Now, of course, now we're what, 30, 35 years later, and now they're fully integrated in the DC universe, which we could talk about, you know, later as well. But at that time, you know, the tarnishment that would have been done to the Charlton comics would have not made them as usable at that time. So they said, can you maybe just not use the Charlton comics? So he decided he was going to still do it. He was not really going to change much about it. He did change Nightshade to be more like, because now that he was freed from having to use Nightshade, who he wasn't, you know, particularly crazy about, he wanted to use a character that was more like Black Canary. And we could talk about that again when we talk about Silk Spectre. But the characters were kind of influenced by that. Specifically, as we're going to talk in a few minutes about Rorschach, was inspired by a character called The Question, Vic Sage, who became a major DC character later and is one of my favorites as the DC Comics version of Vic Sage. But Vic Sage, in turn, was a Ditko creation, a Steve Ditko creation, and he was kind of based on a character that Steve Ditko had done for Wits End Comics, which is kind of an underground black and white comic. He had written it and drawn it himself, and it was a character called Mr. A, who was also a reporter who wore a mask to fight crime. But Mr. A, this is how my husband described him, and I just thought it was very apropos. It's like reading a brochure for, you know, remember those old comics, you guys maybe don't remember, they're about like, you know, don't play D&D, the devil's gonna get you. Do you guys remember what those are called? Chick something?
Jack Chick.
So it reads like a Jack Chick comic on Ayn Rand. It's basically just long pontifications about Ayn Randian philosophy. But it, again, it's a guy who wears a mask and looks very much like Rorschach in The Question. And his calling card, where Rorschach has a calling card that's kind of a, you know, Rorschach image, his calling card is one side black and one side white. And it's kind of his philosophy is, and of course the comic is black and white itself. And it's very much just an Ayn Rand propaganda piece. And we can talk a little bit about it too. And this was a big influence on Alan Moore. And if you're like, well, oh no, 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 is this really, it was such a big influence on him that his musical group that he did for his spare time for a while, actually the Emperors of Ice Cream, did a song called Mr. A. And I'm going to put the link to the YouTube of that song on the blog so that you guys can hear it. It is a song about Steve Ditko, and specifically references Mr. A quite a bit. I'm, you know, going to be clear that Alan Moore had nothing but respect for Steve Ditko, but they were very much not the same. This is something we can talk about as well. They were not politically on the same page. So the quote goes, Steve Ditko was a Randian. So I'll read you what Alan Moore said. So let's just put that out there. So he says, I can look at a Salvador Dali's work and marvel at it, despite the fact that I believe that Dali was probably a completely disgusting human being and borderline fascist. But that doesn't detract from the genius of his artwork. With Steve Ditko, I at least felt as though Steve Ditko's political agenda was very different to mine. Steve Ditko had a political agenda, and that in some ways set him above his contemporaries. During the 60s, I learned pretty quickly about the sources of Steve Ditko's ideas, and I realized very early on that he was very fond of the writing of Ayn Rand. Steve Ditko is completely at the other end of the spectrum for me. I wouldn't say that I was far left in terms of communism, but I am an anarchist, which is 180 degrees away from Steve Ditko's position. But I have a great deal of respect for the man and certainly respect for his artwork and the fact that there is something about his uncompromising attitude that I have a great deal of sympathy with. It's just that the things I wouldn't compromise about or that he wouldn't compromise about are probably very different. And I think this is something we could talk about now versus 35 years ago, or even this interview was 20 years ago. You could have a different opinion and respect someone who thought about the world differently from you because the stakes weren't as high. I mean, mm-hmm. the stakes were high for different reasons. It was, you know, we're talking about, '85 wasn't the Vietnam War, but it was still, you know, a time where that was fresh in people's memories and it was still very much hit home, but it wasn't so much today when you see how radical opinions can shape things. So he did have a respect for Steve Ditko, but it is, you know, kind of, and I'm kind of learning about, you know, Ditko, you're like, yeah, Spider-Man and Miss Doctor Strange. Right? And then you're like, oh, Mr. A. So Steve Ditko, and to his credit, Steve Ditko, you know, about not much very long before he died, wrote a note, which I will also put up on the website with a link, as it was very clear that he did not want Mr. A collected and put out as a graphic novel. It is, however, being collected and put out as a graphic novel, partly because his inheritors, you know, want money, but it's probably might partly be because they agree with the philosophy in the book, whereas, you know, Ditko seems to have moved away from it as he got older. So that is where Rorschach comes from. Rorschach comes, and you know, I mean, he has admitted that it is partly just looking at the vigilante hero in general, and if someone had a scarring event in their childhood, you know, what, you know, I was just listening to an interview where he was talking about how, well, how come in the real world today you have children who have scarring events in their childhood all the time, and none of them really pick up, you know, masks and capes and go out and try to self-therapy themselves by going after criminals. We're obviously thinking of Batman there, but it's a lot of the heroes in DC Comics especially are that kind of, you know, something bad happened to me and now I'm going to fight, to make sure it doesn't happen to somebody else. And we don't see that a lot, and that it would take a particular kind of mental...
socially maladjusted.
Yes, it is a particular kind of personality maybe that was already leaning in that direction, but embraced a philosophy. And the thing about it is, I mean, I'm sure this has always been around, but we definitely see it a lot these days with mm-hmm. this kind of, you've talked yourself into a philosophy of life where, you know, others are not, other life, people's lives are not of value, or they need to be punished, or I mean, we could talk about it not just in terms of people that wear trench coats and go and shoot other people, you know, which is, you know, very much, you know, we could talk about, you know, how the trench coat has become associated with that kind of philosophy. You know, it's, you know, everyone tries to associate it with, you know, Neo.
Can I make another
observation? Of course.
About the idea of people, and I want to put this to the group at large here. When you say the idea that in society we don't have as many people picking up masks and defending, you know, and fighting crime, what is your guys' take on the idea that thanks to the internet, theoretically you can pick up a mask, i.e. another person's avatar, i.e. an anime avatar, i.e. something like that, and you can still see yourself as that kind of person. And in doing so, does that make people more maladjusted, or does it make them less maladjusted, or what's your guys' take on that?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I don't know. I think people have been putting on masks forever. I think the medium's just changed. I don't know if it's ever... I think that's the eternal question. I don't know if that's ever going to change. I don't know.
for the first time, though, with the internet, and this is something that I hope will be relevant in the show as well. For the first time with the internet, you can have people who will be able to put on masks and who, you know, can jump on the show, and if they don't like something that the show says or does, then they can say, you know, hey, Damon Lindenhoff, I hope you die in a fire. And
but see, Rorschach wouldn't do that, right? Rorschach.
Like,
so that's the difference. Like, saying to someone, you know, hiding behind a mask to do something, to say something like that, does it? Rorschach, of course, is more concerned with the outcome. He's not, he doesn't make threats.
No. Right? No, he doesn't make threats because he just does it.
Yes. Yeah. Because he's kind of, it's like, and the thing that I find about Rorschach that's kind of very different is I feel like when people do something like what Rorschach felt he was doing, right, they tend to, in our society anyway, it's like they might wear a mask to do it, but they can't seem to hold it in. It, like, they have to brag about it, you know?
Yeah. And with Rorschach, of course, he, like, very, like, personalizes his mask. Like, the mask mm-hmm. is him versus being a disguise of some sort.
Yeah, it's his, so, yeah, his real face is the mask, almost.
Yep.
Okay. I still think that there's a corollary to be had between Rorschach, and that probably is why I would argue for a lot of people today Rorschach is seen as a sort of heroic character, and I'm not defending the character at all. I want to make that very, very clear. But it's worth pointing out that when you have characters like Batman, or you have characters like this tortured vigilante sort of individual who put on a mask and fight crime. People do brag about it because they see that the mask is themselves. And, you know, Batman may not brag about it, but we're still taught to revere him.
Mm-hmm.
There's always mm-hmm. that spirit that's like, if you can be, if you can't be anybody else, if you can be Batman, don't be anybody else. You know, that one feature. So it's mm-hmm. like, people like Rorschach because, you know, he owns it, and because he is like Batman and everybody else, you know, they can just see themselves, because people want to be like that. So they're like, hey, I'm like this person.
Yeah, I think people see things that go wrong or bad things happen and want to have that same ability or power or courage or insanity or whatever it is to do what he can do, because that takes a whole level of self to do that kind of. So I think people see him as real, like, oh, I could possibly do that. And if I see a lady getting mugged in the alleyway, I could take him on. I think that he represents something that feels more real than even Batman does, which I think is part of what's scary about him, too, is that I get why people relate to him, you know? Like, but mm-hmm. I think that's why he's accessible.
Well, you know, Batman, of course, would save the, you know, the prostitute getting beaten by her pimp. And then would, like, you know, give her money and send
yeah.
her to a women's shelter,
and
right?
Give her housing.
Rorschach would mm-hmm. probably beat her up after he mm-hmm. stuff the pimp. You know, it's interesting. And I mean, I think people, there's the idea of the vigilante that uses a mask to cover up their identity. And of course, with Rorschach, that's not the case. He has no other identity. He is the mask. The mask
yeah.
is his only face. His disguise is dressing up as himself and standing outside the comedian's funeral with a sign, right? Nobody knows who he is because he's nobody. Mm-hmm. And when the police finally unmask him, when they finally catch him at Moloch's house and they unmask him, they're like, who's this guy?
Yeah, he's just
exactly.
mm-hmm. yeah. And he isn't impressive. And I think, all right, so one of the quotes I read, one day Alan Moore got on Goodreads and just answered a bunch of questions. And one of them, and I think I might have mentioned this in the last podcast, but the one that really kind of hit home was a mother of a 14-year-old boy, and she's concerned about him because he was you know, dressing up as Rorschach and pretending, you know, and kind of taking on that persona, you know, maybe talking without, you know, using a lot of extraneous words. but you know, here, let me pull it up and I'll actually read it to you. So I'm guessing that he perhaps, I might have read this last time, but he says, so I'm guessing that he's perhaps read Watchmen and that maybe he found certain qualities of the character of Rorschach to be admirable. Although I wrote that character to show what the internal social life of a justice-obsessed mass vigilante would most probably actually be like, I've actually had a couple of grown adults tell me how much they identified with the character, which again is just a futile attempt to be the most scary thing in a world that you personally find scary. These were adults, and in neither case did they end in what you'd call an enviable state. Luckily, your son is 14. When his behavior is completely normal and understandable, he will realize, as I did, that nobody in their right mind wants to go out with Skeletor or Ernst Darbo Blofeld, and he will probably adjust and moderate his balance until he reaches a point where he feels confident and happy in himself. So, and that to me kind of like, it made a lot of sense, you know, because I remember being a kid and I remember high school being terrifying, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't think I would ever identify with Rorschach, but that's because, you know, he was fairly sexist and racist and homophobic and, you know, keep adding some ands on there. So hey, there's at one point where he's talking to Veidt and he's like, and Veidt's like, well, you know, the comedian was a Nazi, and he's like, comedian was a Nazi, well, I'm, you know, you might as well call me a Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
And Veidt's like, but yeah, and it is, it's that anger against the world is trying to find some way to put a name to your hate.
Mm-hmm.
So has anybody here reading Doomsday Clock?
Not yet.
I have read like 6 issues, or I want to say like 6 issues, but you know, with all the delays, it's been a while. Okay. Since I so got into they, it.
They did, Geoff Johns did an interesting thing with the character. The Rorschach in Doomsday Clock is not, hold on. The Rorschach in Doomsday Clock is not Walter Kovacs. The Rorschach in Doomsday Clock is actually, if you recall, the section of Watchmen where Rorschach has the whole issue where Rorschach is talking to the psychologist. And by the end, the psychologist he's kind of caught the bug. You know, he's caught Rorschach's way of looking at the world. Like an infection. Transference, I suppose. The Rorschach in Doomsday Clock is actually Reggie Long, Malcolm Long's son.
Mm.
You know, he is just as violent, and I will say I really don't want to watch Saturn Girl standing by while Rorschach beats somebody to death. But I don't know where the story's going, and it may be a very long time before anybody actually does. the same with the comedian. I don't know why he was brought back, but you know, hopefully that will still be revealed. But I did think that it was an interesting take to kind of show that this had continued on. That it was
mm-hmm.
it was almost like that it was catchy,
almost like a legacy character, really. Like
literally,
yeah. Though.
Well, what, and that was probably, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, what a twist, though. I mean, you mentioned it's a legacy character. It's a traditionally legacy character. It's something positive. I mean, like, you get characters of a very, I'm not as familiar with the DC version of the characters beyond the Bat family, but you get these characters who are, like, taking on the mantle. Most stories tend to, you know, explore characters taking on the mantle and having it be a positive thing, or having difficulty adapting to taking on the mantle. Like, I know that I am not as deeply versed in Bat lore as I would like to be, because I was always more to be villain as far as being the Batman. But I just due to a lack of positive representation for people who are mentally ill and gay in media. And but looking at the Bat family, like, I always kind of read that, you know, everybody, Dick Grayson and all the other Bat kids were like, wow, Batman's great. And it's like, dude, no, he's not.
Yeah, I got some books I can let you read.
It depends. It really depends.
When it comes to Marvel, which is admittedly a little bit more my speed, Marvel takes it and all these characters take on the mantle, like Miss Marvel, Kamala Khan, and Hawkeye, Kate Bishop, all these different characters take on the mantle, and they excel at it because they have these role models. And DC, I think, the fact that they've admitted, okay, well, you can have problems trying to live up to something, and the fact that they own that you can, negativity will be also be passed on. You're telling me about this, and admittedly, I haven't read Doomsday Clock, mostly because Wendy was like, it's not done yet. Wait until it's done.
I can't tell you if it's good until I know where he's going.
That's good advice, though, because it's kind of... Like, it's been launched, like, years ago, I think.
But I haven't read Doomsday Clock, so it's like, when you have the idea that you can pass down evil and hatred and even the idea that you're doing the right thing is so telling. And it's very much something that that I think that DC and Marvel perhaps do need to acknowledge, that Alan Moore made these comics because he wanted to appeal to a certain generation. He wanted to appeal to keep adults who would grown up reading these Silver Age heroes. And what happened was, it made a lot of people really excited to do a lot of crazy stuff with comic books, but we're paying for that crazy stuff now by having people who are like, well, comic books should only be this way. There should only be overly large, muscled white dudes running around. There should be sitting in the shadows and being sad and having no emotions. And there should be lots of women with plant food. And...
It's better than it was. I think there's this weird reaction. I feel like the 90s was just, it just went in a really bad place. And I think this happens with all of Alan Moore's stuff. And you can hear him talk time and time again as you talk to him about each book. He's like, what he meant to do was give you an intellectual look at something. He wanted to make you think about something. I'm going to reiterate this again. He loved the Silver Age comics, and he wrote really great stories. If you want to read the greatest love story ever to the Silver Age Superman family, you need to go and pick up Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. And it's a love story to Luther. It's a love story to Brainiac. It's a love story to the Legion. It's a love story to Superman and Supergirl. And it's perfect. And he gets it, and he loves it, and it's not, it's all he wanted to do. I mean, go read, some of the work that he did over when he started his own company with America's Best, right? I mean, it's still that kind of happy, strong stuff. Yes, you don't want to have Comics Code Authority, breathing down your neck, but it's not, his intention wasn't for all comics to become the Watchmen,
And I would say not only that, but it is also like I think some of his more, I want to say recent, but I'm talking like at least like the past decade, whenever he would get quoted in the media, it'd be like something really negative framed as like hating on another creator or something like that. Like I know there were some things like when Geoff Johns was doing Blackest Night and he's just said, oh, well, DC digging in my garbage, like something like that. But I think people really just pump those up because it's a really sensational kind of thing, and it's not, maybe not his actual intention, because I think he's more of a, he wants to do more things like creatively in a way. So Watchmen was different, but he didn't want everything to be Watchmen, like you said. And like when he did his Green Lantern stories, which on my opinion is that Jeff was just using it as a springboard and he did his own thing anyway, but I will give Alan, I'll let him say his piece because it's his work. And I think he was just saying, well, add more stuff to the universe or write something else entirely. You don't have to use my old stories. But people would take that as, oh, well, he doesn't like modern writers, he doesn't like modern superheroes, etc., etc. And I don't think that is within him, really.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say we've come to the point where we're deconstructing our deconstructionist deconstruction. Yeah. it's just we're at the point now where I am really, and we got to get back to Rorschach, but I am really tired of you know, let's see who we can corrupt and kill and compromise. Okay. And I'm just like,
Eric,
I'm
not gonna yeah. Don't get me started on Heroes in Crisis on here. I'll never.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the thing is that you can dig. I mean, so I felt like Mr. Miracle, except for the fact where he might be dead, deconstructed Scott and Barda in a positive way that showed them as people and made them more relatable. And then you get Heroes in Crisis, which is a hot mess and kind of irresponsible, but it's like, I feel like he's like, well, they want me to do something groundbreaking. What kind of use it's groundbreaking? And it's like, you kind of panic and you decide, all right, let's just destroy something. You know, and it's just, you know, Watchmen was what may have destroyed the Charlton Comics characters if they had been used, but they weren't. And it didn't, you know, it wasn't meant to destroy the genre. It was just meant to make you think. They don't live in our world.
No.
Yeah, that's very clear, actually. Like, as soon as Dr. Manhattan is, like, shown to the world, everything changes. They have different technology, and
yeah,
everything is totally different. So.
You guys are operating under the perception, and you say the different things, and I'll tie it back into workshop. I say you guys are operating under the perception that people have a good grasp on reality versus fiction, and while large groups of people frequently don't, and those people are the ones who normally listen to that kind of thing, and tying it into Rorschach and going back to him, that's something that I think it will influence a lot of characters in the show, because like Rorschach's journals could easily be taken as fiction, but you see in the show in the promo image, you see people wearing his mask and kind of worshiping him for it. So yes. It's all about what you believe is like fiction and it's not fiction. People, my favorite line in all of media will always perpetually apply to everything, which is that a person is smart, people are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and everybody knows it.
Mm-hmm.
So
So that's a good segue into the show a little bit. I mean, we can come back out and talk some more about, you know, the question or Rorschach or Mystery if you want. But in the show, obviously Rorschach is. So we don't know. So there's still this kind of thing out there that this may not be in the same universe, but I think we can pretty confidently say that it is in the same universe because of all of the things that we've seen, pictures of the squid. You know, Silk Spectre is now older. Dr. Manhattan has been away and is possibly coming back. This is probably set in the same universe. So in that universe, at the end of the Watchmen book, Rorschach takes his journal and mails it to his favorite right-wing publication called The Frontiersman. And the kind of at the end, it appears as if they were having a slow news day and they were going to print excerpts from the journal. If that happened, then everyone would possibly be exposed. Whether or not people believed it would be another story. I would assume that Veidt would have been in jail. But you never know. He's very smart. He may still have figured out that, yeah, he would publish the journal. But again, I mean, it isn't kind of a, you know, right-wing conspiracy paper. Which now would probably be a website, not to name names, but
don't promote.
But yes, but so you know, it could be like, you know, a conspiracy. It could be deemed a conspiracy theory, and again, it is just a journal. They can't even prove that it was from Rorschach, and now Rorschach has disappeared. And did Rorschach ever exist? And who knows? The people picking it up, you know. They do represent people who believe in a conspiracy theory and who are willing to do drastic things because in their reality, like you said, they believe them to be true. And I feel that is what's going on with this country right now, is there are a lot of people who believe things to be true, and it drives a fear and drives them to make choices. They're not necessarily true. In Rorschach's case, maybe it is. Maybe I'm counter to myself there. But yeah, we can talk about whether or not Veidt did the right thing and Manhattan did the right thing when we get to that episode.
True. Okay.
So Does anybody want to talk about the question at all, or the fact that, I mean, somebody else can talk about the fact that the question is not the same character? I know this is some other topics that I thought up, like maybe we could talk about Renee Montoya. I don't know if it really relates.
Yeah, I was going to say, the only question I really got to know as well as was Renee. I got to know Vic at the very end when he basically passed the baton on to Renee. I don't really know Vic as well as I know Renee, so I don't know. I can't really give as much. Yeah.
I know I'm 52 as well. I think that's what you're talking about. So,
yeah.
Like 52 in Justice League Unlimited, where, I mean, it's not a bad version, but it's not the same as having read the whole run.
But I mean, Justice League Unlimited does play him in kind of a conspiracy vein. Yeah, it's not so much the detective, it's more the there's a conspiracy and I'm putting all these lines together.
No, he reminded me actually when I rewatched JLU, right after I binged X-Files, he reminded me so much of the other one, Mulder. He reminded me so much like with the conspiracy theories and like that. And I was just like, and back then when I was originally watching this, I found it like, I was like, oh yeah, like super charming. But like now that I've like seen that side from like actual insane, like people who are like really believe that the earth is flat, I'm like, what is happening? And like, it's just so intense. Like, it's like that level of like, it's like, oh, it's charming when they believe it's like aliens and they want to storm Area 51, but it's less charming when they think that, like, you know, there's a pedophile ring in a pizza joint, you know? So it's just...
Yes.
So it's, yeah.
Yes, yes.
The one raid has been canceled. It is now the Sony raid. Thank you. You can go. No, joke. Please don't go.
Oh my gosh. So I think, yeah, no, it's, oh my gosh. So I think, so Vic Sage, there's some really good comics I can probably recommend to you guys. It's the DC Vic Sage was good. I have not read a lot of The Question from back in Charlton days. In general, Charlton was a lot more right-wing. There were elements to it. That we can talk to more about, you know, that we're a little bit more progressive when we get to Thunderbolt. But there was also a lot of really racist and uncomfortable stuff. Okay. Like, I mean, you know, everybody complains about how, like, you know, there weren't, when you go to the 1966 Legion, there was, you know, they were all white kids except for the green guy and the blue girl. But you then compare that to the kind of just horrible, flat-out racism that was going on in the Charlton comics was just mind-blowing. So I'm not saying that it was good. I'm saying that we talked a lot on the, if you go back to the early, the very first episode of Swamp Thing, we talked a lot about Comics Code. So I would recommend if you're interested in learning about the Comics Code, go back there and listen to that episode. But you know, it's just, it was kind of uncomfortable for me to read. If anyone read it at the time and enjoyed, I would love to hear, like, if you as a kid grew up with The Question, or, you know, we're going to talk about Peacemaker in a minute, and enjoyed those comics. I'd love to hear, you know, what you would recommend I go back and try reading, because I'm totally open to going back and giving it another shot. But with the lens of understanding that, oof, you know.
You can't draw people in those ways.
Yeah. Or write them in those ways, I guess. It's like, even when they're trying to be, you know, inclusive and progressive, it just ends up being a cartoon. And you're like, oh, boy. Yeah. Kind of like, you know, everybody's like Haji from Johnny Quest. Just like, oh, boy. but yeah, so yeah, and it is intriguing that it's Renee Montoya now, who is, you know, everybody knows that Renee is, I think, I'm going to go with lesbian. I think, you know, in the very beginning, she dated some men, but she's a lesbian. And, you know, and of course, she's Latina.
Renee?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, so, and just, you know, an amazing character all around, but it was a really great passing of the torch. I mean, they put her character through some rough times, and she came out better than her partner, who ended up being the Spectre. So,
oh my God. So, you know,
if you're going to take that into the stick.
So tragic.
Yeah, so the irony of, you know, Ditko's right-wing Ayn Rand creation, you know, evolving into a, you know, Latino lesbian detective was just, you know, I thought that was kind of progression.
Yeah, love to see it.
So, yeah, so the concept of black and white with the Rorschach mask, and the mask has the swirling liquid in it. And the thing that he likes most about the mask, which is described as like two layers of fabric with liquid in between, which is kind of very different than what we saw in the movie, which was, couldn't possibly exist, I think. But it's like, I like that kind of idea of like, it's like some kind of like a oil in between, oil and water. But the reason why he liked it is that no matter how much they swirled around, they would never bleed together. There'd never be a gray area. It would always be black and white. And Mr. A, you know, again, his calling card was a half, was one side black, one side white card. So it was all about the, you know, they do not exist. This is right and this is wrong and they do not. And, you know, I don't think that the racism is definitely implied there as well.
Right. I was wondering, like, I always found that fascinating, like, the viewing the world. And I was reading something, and I was like, all the Mr. A comics were in black and white, except for the covers or something. And because to, like, tell that, like, very linear story. And I'm like, so in this world, people who are not black or white do not exist. Like, what, or do they exist? I don't know. It's so bizarre to me to even, like, look at the world that way, because I've always lived in, like, yeah, there's things that go on a spectrum, but in terms of, like, I don't know, color, it just, I don't know, it's just very bizarre to me to, like, look at the world that way. So I've, when I was reading up on Ayn Rand, like, that was just kind of like, oh, okay, that's where that comes from. Okay, cool. That's not where I haven't even conceptualized my world, or that's not even my perspective anyway. So I've never considered any of these people or any of these, like, you know, ciphers for Mr. A or whoever as heroes, in my opinion. I think they're just people who really exist, and that's it. I find them weird.
So I think the way that we set it up, I think, will be interesting, because the way that we picked, there's the six characters we're going to review for the character spotlight. In part one, we have what I would call really the right wing. You know, we have, you know, Rorschach and the comedian. And then at the very last two, we're going to do our Dr. Manhattan and Ozymandias, who have, like, you know, a completely gray morality, right?
Yeah, like very high level.
My faves.
So, yeah, it's like it's both, you know, obviously both ends of the spectrums are considered. You can consider them to be more the villains of the story, where it's kind of, but again, Owlman and Silk Spectre aren't that, they're kind of not even affecting anything, right? I'm sorry. What did I say, Owlman?
They're like the
Night Owl and Silk Spectre are just kind of the middle, and they're not even pushing the story one way or the other. They're just kind of
like humans
in the flow. Yeah, they're the humans.
And yeah, so I was thinking, like, yeah, the humans, and then you have Rorschach and comedian who kind of play the devils, and then you have, you know, Ozzy and Doc trying to play gods, or in their case, being
that
gods.
That's an interesting way to look at it. I really like that.
Yeah. I've always looked at it. You know that painting? I think we've probably all seen that that movie that Zack Snyder made, was it Batman versus Superman? Where he was, Lex Luthor kept referring to the painting, to the senator, of, like, the angel that, I know it was, like, a famous artist made it, but he was like, it was like the angels coming down from heaven and the devils coming from below to fight, and we were in the middle. That's kind of how I viewed those six, you know,
where the angels come down from heaven and then the thing and the humans are in the middle. I think it was the Sistine Chapel.
I think he had it on a wall, in the painting, and it was, I think it probably was someone who painted the Sistine Chapel. I know art, and so I remember him referencing it, and he was saying, what if the devils came from above, basically saying the aliens or the devils or whatever. But I just remember looking at that painting, and I was like, I just always think of that as the kind of, like, dichotomy of the devils, us, and the gods playing a game, basically. Anyway, that was just kind of how I thought about it.
Well,
I mean, that is kind of how they did. Like, you know, they were playing games with people's lives with all the...
Even in their own way. Yeah. Even in their own way, Rorschach and the comedian were playing games with people's lives, too, even if they didn't think about it that way.
No, yeah. And they didn't.
Yeah. All right, so do we have anything else that we want to say about Rorschach? So... before
should we just go over like the biographical stuff about him, like
yes all right, so let's do a quick stuff we know about Rorschach so that you can I'm kind of assuming that like everybody knows everything about Rorschach but maybe we do need to kind of go over what happened in the comics as a refresher to anybody that doesn't want to pick it up again. I do highly recommend reading it because
just read it again.
It's so good.
Yeah, you may not be in love with Rorschach, which you were never intended to be, but I think I've read enough Alan Moore quotes. I've got more if you want. Rorschach is supposed to be stinky. He doesn't bathe because he's completely obsessed. It's all he thinks about. He doesn't take care of himself. You know, it's a completely different way of thinking. So, but it is, you know, it is an amazing. Obviously, it's one of the greatest graphic novels of all time.
Yeah, very riveting. It's hard to put down.
But how about we do that? How about Tony? Do you want to start by like kind of like start giving us the highlights of Rorschach in The Watchmen, and then we can move into Before Watchmen if you want to.
Okay. I guess like we start with the childhood, basically. His mother was very abusive and not a great mother, so he got taken away from her. I think he was about, I want to say, 6. And throughout the comic, the Watchmen comic, we find this out through the doctor interviewing him. And it really, and some of it is public record as well. Like they have like social worker reports and letters he wrote when he was a child. And it's really... you could see that his worldview was kind of shaped even that early when he was like prepubescent or like very young teenager, where he was like, he really like, he never knew his father, but he would like put so much on his father. Like his father must be a great man, like President Truman, who he also said was a great man. I'm not sure why. I mean, no disrespect to Truman, but, you know, like, that was felt kind of, well, like, maybe he's just picking a dude. So he was very, like, attached to this idea of his father being the perfect man sort of thing. And he really, because, I mean, it's justified. She was a horrible person. But, like, later he finds out that his mother gets killed. And his first thing he says is good, like, because she deserved it. And, you know, realistically, yeah, he's right, but it's in the report because that's a bit troubling to hear a child say about their parent. So I believe after that, he goes to work in the dress factory. Well, he works in a dress factory, a garment factory, and that's where he gets the material for his mask. And his first outing, he's not really fully transformed. He's just trying to do the hero thing because it's kind of popular in their world. So he's doing the hero thing and stopping, you know, normal criminals and stuff like that. And the case that kind of turns him into Rorschach is a kidnapped girl. She's a kidnapped, like 6-year-old, and he is really investigating it. He ends up at a backyard area where he sees these dogs chewing on bones. And the comic doesn't tell you right there, but the bones belong to the child, and that kind of, he really lost control, I guess you could say, or maybe not, because it's Rorschach. I don't know if he loses control, it goes into a rage or anything, but he really, like, slaughtered those animals, and then he found the owner, and he was, like, he went to the owner, and think that was the guy he locked to something, and set the building on fire. And that was kind of his turning point as far as actually becoming Rorschach and not really, like, not associating with his past, really, in a meaningful way at all.
Mm-hmm. And if you notice in the very first lines he says when, at the start of the book, or about dead dog on the sidewalk, and it's like it's not a dead dog. It's the comedian, right? but it's definitely a flashback, and evokes that memory that you don't find out about to a few issues later. But that is the story that drove Doomsday Clock's Rorschach's father to kind of lose his mind, and that is an excellent issue of the comic. We're talking about single issues to pick out. Once Rorschach is in prison, the way that he gets into the mind of a psychiatrist, it almost like Harley Quinn wasn't invented for like another 20 years after that, but you could see.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Yeah. The inspiration for how the psychiatrist becomes, infected, by hearing them about the madness of his patient.
Yeah. I think about that issue in particular, we're going to nerd out about the comic for a little while, is as you read the issue, the thought pattern, it's basically like monologued by the doctor, so like you can see his thoughts kind of warping, and his pattern of pattern of speech in his head is really mimicking Rorschach after a while, and he really is starting to disassociate from things that aren't his job, and he talks about crazy Rorschach crimes at dinner and freaks people out and stuff, and it's a bit like foreboding in a way, because you don't want to see it, but it's really interesting to actually read and just see how it's plotted. Like, I really love that kind of, oh man, I could see it developing thing.
That's what I was going to say. I wonder how, if at all, how that kind of influence, Rorschach's influence, will play out in the show, people wearing his face.
Yeah.
And I wonder if did that inspection spread? Like, that's the best way to word, the best word to use it, to describe it, is infection. Yeah. He spread, it just was to one person, and then his little diary got to how many people? I mean, I wonder if that's something that they'll fully address. Like, are there literally 50 to 60 people thinking like him? That's like effing disturbing. It's really disturbing, but like, I wonder if there's not just like the one psychiatrist that's now who's an intelligent college educated man, think about that infection spreading to like uneducated rednecks with pitchforks and white hoods, like that's an interesting, something terrifying I just thought of.
And this is something that scientists are now studying, and there's actually quite a few studies going on about this, that things like fear, paranoia, racism, hate
is genetic,
can be tracked with the exact same models as infectious diseases. So you can see if you introduce one person who is hateful into a society, people will start to turn, right? Just like it works the same with introducing peace into hate, but it's obviously a much harder battle.
Yeah,
it's not as easy.
Like vampirism. Yeah. It's like vampirism. You just bite one person. It's easier to be bad than to be good.
It's the same models. It's the same model. So it is that kind of idea. However, I'm willing to put it out there that these people are, it's more of a superficial thing. Whereas I feel like that Rorschach's was repeated PTSD, repeated disassociation, because he had so many terrible things happen to him as a child. He had so many terrible things. The dog situation was just the point at which, he had to keep compartmentalizing himself until he lost who he was entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of understand that. I mean, it doesn't make him a stable hero, but it is, you can understand how it gets there. I mean, if you've had a traumatic event, it changes the way you see the world. Especially if there's something where it's like it goes off. If you have something really bad happen, it can be like 6 months before you've got your brain organized enough that you can go and do normal human things, So I mean, having, everybody's experienced some kind of trauma in their life where, to some degree, it changes the way you look at the world. Right. So I think I can see that. I think that's not necessarily true for a lot of the hate that goes on in this country. It's not really, it's based on perceived stuff and not, and I think most of the hate in this country, you know, while there are people who have hate because they have trauma, you know, some people, a lot of people, you know, have these kind of basic hatreds because they caught it from somebody else. Mm-hmm. Or they caught it from somebody else, right? Mm-hmm. They had a lot of anger. Again, I mean, like, we go back to the Alan Moore's, you know, scariest thing in a scary world, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to feel safer. So directing your hate towards someone else might make you feel safer, which is a very cowardly thing to do. But, you know.
That's a perfect segue into the comedian.
All right, we'll take the segue. We can always come back and talk about Chuck later.
Okay. Oh, the comedian.
Okay. Hi, kids. I'm Carolyn, and I'll be talking about a little bit about the comedian, a.k.a. the peacemaker, a.k.a. Christopher Smith. So, before I get started, I want to ask my co-host a question, and I would like to hear from each of them in turn about this question. The question is, it is interesting that people like Rorschach have developed a sort of cult following, but that people like the comedian are pretty much regarded as a negative character. While people sit there and they look at the comedian, yeah, he does die in the first scene, we still get to know him through flashbacks. And he doesn't have the same sort of following as Rorschach does. But the comedian represents a lot of major tropes. So, co-host, why do you think that is?
I think it's because I think violence, the way a comedian views violence, is it crosses a line that even most people can't even bend their own morality rules for. Most people can suspend some sort of, you know, their suspension of disbelief. Rorschach never murdered a pregnant woman ever, as far as we know. So I think a lot of what the comedian was doing, what he did was so much and so violent and so toxic. Like, that was toxic masculinity that people were like, oh yeah, that's toxic masculinity. They'll acknowledge that because that's the most extreme example you can find because it was so violent and he found it funny. And people, I didn't think it's just, people were just like, I don't think that people really wanted to touch. And I'm just saying that because I actually get the comedian a little bit more than I got Rorschach, but I get why Rorschach had a more of a cult following because the comedian was just too much, I think, versus Rorschach who just, he was trying to do the right, in his mind, he was trying to do the right thing versus the comedian who didn't give a damn either way.
So, yeah, I'm going to take it from the Carlton Comics perspective, right, to start with. Carlton Comics, so the Carlton Comics character that the comedian is based on is very much a kind of personification of the way America thought of itself at the time. His slogan, and when I said this to my husband, he's like, this is the joke, right? And I'm like, no, it may be a joke, but it's not a joke when it was first used, right? His slogan is, a man who loves peace so much that he's willing to fight for it. And he did. So he tended to go after dictators. He was a pacifist who used non-lethal weapons, but it was still very much a reign of terror, right? Like Batman uses non-lethal mm-hmm. weapons, but he's all about terror. So this is kind of what, and yes, America didn't always use non-lethal weapons, but we're willing to go to war to protect peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is what we did, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Huh? But that is really what the comedian was meant to represent
mm-hmm.
in, you know, being the peacemaker. And then, you know, now the comedian in Watchmen, and he is a reflection
of America.
Yeah, of America.
And he really is. And it's terrible. I don't think people like it.
It's not
honestly, yet, so. he's a very colorful, but he's a parody of America. I think most people don't like that. But the red flag, the beautifully decorated uniform with the red flag, the ever present cigar is just very America, you know, the love of mm-hmm. God, you know, so I think that's part of it too. But anyway, go ahead, Wendy.
For General Ross, right?
Yeah. And
I think that the thing that the reason why he's probably not, he's definitely a metaphor, right? But the reason why he's not a character is because he's seen entirely as a foil slash reflection slash way to help you understand the other characters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. He's like, every time you see the comedian, it is because of how, what he does. Yes, it's a reflection on the comedian, but it's not as him as a person. Like, mm-hmm. killing the woman in Vietnam wasn't about the comedian. You already knew he was scumbucket, mm-hmm. you know, up there. But at that point, it was to show what was happening to Dr. Manhattan. And again, later, it's Laurie's remembering things about the comedian that brings back his humanity. So the two times you see the comedian in relation to Dr. Manhattan, it is, you know, the point at which you realize his humanity is fading away and the point at which you realize it can come back.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of more closer to Vanessa's take, where I do think it has to do with, basically, comedian is kind of like, he's almost given up on humanity in a way. And I think ultimately, when you're reading like a story involving superheroes and all that, you kind of still want, well, you still want the bad guys to lose, and you want people to have a understandable motive versus just kind of chaotic sort of stuff mm-hmm. that comedian does. Like, he didn't really have to kill a pregnant woman. He could have just like left her alone. I mean, he just left her there and abandoned her, and nothing bad would have happened. But, you know, he chose, like, he just chooses, like, the, like, I guess it's just because he doesn't care. He's very, like, I'm trying to think of the word, but he's just very, like, nihilistic, where he just mm-hmm. is just kind of done with everything and everyone. It didn't even seem like he wanted to join the Crime Busters, which I guess, I don't know if we even said that name yet, but that was the name of their hero team. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even, like, I don't think he even wanted to join them, really, but he went along with it because, like, what else was he going to do? So, since he's just kind of, like, he seems almost, he doesn't have ambition, and I think people really, like, kind of cling to that sort of, well, this is what this character wants to do, so I'm going to see how they do it or see if they can do it, that kind of thing, and that kind of is how you become a fan versus seeing a guy just kind of there and almost going with the flow, but not in a fun way, I guess.
Okay.
So do we think...
Yeah.
So there's the bits in Laurie's memory, and there's the bit where he goes to Moloch and cries. Just, do we feel like, do people in general, and it's just like, I don't know if we've all talked to a million people about this, but do people in general feel that there was a redemption arc in there somewhere, that he regained humanity at the end, or is it just really just that he just couldn't handle how big Wright's plan was?
I don't think he had a suppose, and I want to say to the group, that Edward Morgan Blake, the comedian, peacemaker, Christopher Smith story is about the peak of toxic masculinity and the ultimate effect that it has on people. No, I do not think he was redeemed. But I do think that he was at a point where, if he hadn't been killed, there is a very good chance that he could have started some sort of redemption. Hear me out. Okay. So, in order to understand the comedian, I don't know why I have so much to say about the character. I hate myself for it. But in order to understand about the comedian, you have to understand something that Wendy left out about the Charlton Comics character. Christopher Smith is a pacifist diplomat so committed to peace that he's willing to use force as a superhero to advance that cause. He uses an array of non-lethal weapons and also pounds of action suit when Stone City goes up against the dictators and warlords. It's straight from the way to see, okay? Smith later learns that his peace through violence efforts are the result of serious mental illness brought on by the shame of having a Nazi death camp commanded for a father, commandant for a father. He believes his father's fear haunts him continuously and criticizes his every move, even if he tries to live down his path.
So, I'm going to caveat that by saying I don't think that was in the original Charlton. I'm pretty sure that was added under DC, possibly post-Watchmen. But yes, we can talk about that in terms of the character. Could be wrong. I'm pretty sure that's post-Charlton.
Yeah, so it's post-Charlton, which makes sense, because Charlton would want to, as Jojo and Vanessa said, Charlton would want to promote the idea of peace through force, because peace through force is a traditionally American concept. Who was it that mentioned Truman earlier? One of you guys.
Tony, yeah.
Okay, Tony mentioned Truman. Truman did a little something called the Truman Doctrine. And the Truman Doctrine fostered containment of communism. Containment was a geopolitical strategy for foreign policy by the United States, loosely related to a bunch of other stuff, blah, 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 blah. And it was basically the Republicans saying, we're going to make sure that we as the United States are going to stomp out communism. And everybody else on the planet was like, okay, we don't really, why is this your job? We don't understand. But you have the nuclear bomb, so we're going to let you do whatever the hell you want. And America's like, cool. So we're going to go to Vietnam. We're going to screw with a bunch of people. We're going to go to a whole bunch of other places and set things in the motion that will ultimately be responsible for the downfall of the United States if the United States isn't careful. And that creates a certain group of people who the comedian represents. He's regularly used as a hard weapon, but accepts it because it's seemingly the right thing to do. Because society has told him over and over again that he's a man, he is this, he is this. And that he has a duty to this country that is making poor decisions. Is making decisions that aren't beneficial to humanity. And so essentially Vanessa and Tony are 100% correct, at least in my opinion, but he represents the pinnacle and downfall of toxic masculinity as observed by a non-binary person because of the peak. And this is a huge trigger warning here, guys. Huge, huge trigger warning, because if you haven't read the comic, you're probably not going to know what I'm talking about. And if you have read the comic, then you're going to know, because we're just going to bring it up, about the rape.
Yeah.
So this is a huge trigger warning. I'm going to say it one more time. Trigger warning, trigger warning. The comedian represents peak of toxic masculinity because he essentially takes women whenever he wants. And that is, at least to me, as a person who has observed masculinity, that is to me the peak of negative emotions for men, is that they can take whatever they want and they will take women if they so choose. And, you know, I just do that. And so that's the peak. And then the downfall is what he goes through when he realizes that, number one, he got the first Silk Spectre pregnant, because I have yet to see anything that contradicts the idea that Lori isn't his daughter.
Well, that was very clear. Manhattan pretty much said that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I haven't seen anything that does that. But essentially what he realizes is that by being a total douche canoe, and forgive my blue-collar colloquialism, but by being a total douche, logic matters, and it should matter to a human being, that society has said it is right, but he doesn't get it because he did everything, because he's the peak of toxic masculinity. I'm not sure if I'm even articulating this well enough, but the whole point, the whole journey of the comedian through Watchmen is that he's sort of this character that inspires all of the other characters to do stuff. But he is this incredibly tragic character. And Rorschach even says that. He tells the famous joke. You know, man goes to the doctor. He says, I'm really depressed. I'm really hurt. I'm not okay. And the doctor says, the solution to this is very simple. Go see the great clown Pagliacci tonight. He'll make you laugh. He'll make you cry. You'll feel really good about yourself afterwards. And the man bursts into tears in front of the doctor. And he says, doctor, I am Pagliacci. Mm-hmm. And it's up, and essentially it's like this character has become such a symbol that he realizes just how hollow it is. So I don't think he has a redemption arc. I don't even know, truthfully, and perhaps that is the sign that he was redeemed. I don't even think he would want. I think he was just perfectly content sitting in his house, reminiscing about being a dick. And his whole life is a product of mental illness. DC recognized that with Peacemaker, because Peacemaker was this symbol that everybody looked up to, and that it was this great character, but his whole thing was a product of being a mental illness.
And except he did break down, so Vite went too far even for the comedian, and he started to... So his whole life is existentialism, right? But you wonder, it's one of those things where it's existentialism until it becomes too real, right? Mm-hmm. Or until it gets too close to home, maybe. But
it's all fun and games until you are confronted with your own something that's beyond your perspective, right? Like, he can conceptualize our plane of existence, like, right, we, you know, people are bad, people are good, there's no good people, there's people are shit or whatever, but the second it goes beyond war, like ending war, he's like, wait, I can see this, it's right, but is it right? Like, I think it kind of broke him. I don't know if he could come back from that. It broke him, I think.
And I think so, and maybe this goes back, and you guys can tell me if this is crazy, but if, you know, if the idea is from this random Goodreads comment that Alan Moore made, that he's going to be the scariest, that his goal, like Rorschach, was to be the scariest thing in a scary world, and then he met someone who was so much scarier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
that he couldn't, you know, he couldn't process it.
You know what that reminds me of? That there's a series by Mark Waid called Invincible, and then there's a sequel series called Incorruptible. And in short, the basic short premise is that in Invincible, Superman goes insane, and it's a character that's based on Superman, and Mark Waid details the progression of Superman going insane, and finally Superman's like, I'm going to go crazy. And he just starts decimating the planet, and Superman, this version of Superman, his version's nemesis, sees it, and is just like, oh my god, this is just, and it completely changes him. So he goes home and he's like, this dude is a total scumbag. He's sleeping with a 16-year-old girl, and he's like stolen all this money, he's stolen all this car, and his 16-year-old girlfriend is like, hey honey, how you doing, blah blah blah, and he's like, dude, we can't sleep together anymore, I have to try and do something heroic because this guy is fucking insane, this guy's crazy. and
it's like, Megamind. Go back to Megamind, right? It's like, wait, what? The good guy goes bad, and then the bad guy has to become the good guy. I mean, we can talk about how, you know, this is not Watchmen, but we can talk about how from certain perspectives, you know, Legolas, Lex Luthor has some pretty valid points. But that's it, is that, yes, with this, it's that part in Deadwood, you know, where Al Swearengen is suddenly the good guy because even badder guys show up into town. I don't know that it's necessarily a redemption, but the morality goalpost has moved.
But someone could argue,
and we will,
that, Ozzy and Doc weren't the bad guys. Just saying, someone could argue. It may not be. I don't know, but we'll see.
You know, I love them. Yeah, you know, we're going to come to that point where we have that morality struggle. We're like, yeah, but, and we'll talk about this when we get there. It's a very different place to be, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. The comedian and Rorschach are using the stuff that they do, the hate that they feel, the transference of their feelings onto other people, you know, as kind of a therapy. Whereas Manhattan and Ozymandias see reality for exactly what it is and know that there is no way to make the noble choice.
Utilitarian.
Yeah.
They're very light.
Yeah. They have to see themselves above us in order to protect us, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, they're playing, I mean, and essentially, you know,
playing God.
I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but they're they're playing a numbers game, and they're like, you know, the reality situation is that here's my choices, you know, and I don't, and to the point where, so the point, you know, here's where the spectrum will come in, and we'll talk about this when we get to Dr. Manhattan, but comedian is an existentialist, right? Mm-hmm. It's very much everything's a joke. Nothing matters. It doesn't. It's all. None of it matters.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Manhattan also is starting to get to the point where he believes nothing matters. You know.
Yeah.
But it's in a much different. Like his is a real belief that nothing matters. Not a. I just don't
like
want
it's
to
not
bother
emotional.
With it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of, you know, are they, you know, the reality. Opposite sides of the mask, you know, to Rorschach and the comedian.
That's an interesting way of putting it. And okay, so we're gonna go all philosophical. Is evil justified by the fact that these characters are using a numbers game? Is it really evil?
You mean
is it evil
Dr. Manhattan or and Ozymandias, or do you mean...
If you were confronted, if you were straight up confronted with somebody like Manhattan, somebody like Ozymandias, and you were either, would you react as Rorschach and the comedian would, or is there ever a point where that reaction, I don't think that reaction is ever justified. What I'm saying is, if you're confronted with something that is so beyond the scope of human understanding, would that be a response? Do you think that would be a human response from anybody?
You mean the comedian's response?
The comedian and Rorschach to a certain extent, yeah. I mean, like, if you...
Rorschach has a set of rules that mm-hmm. govern everything that he does, and so he has to do what he has to do against Manhattan and Ozymandias, and they both know that. Ozymandias and Manhattan know that this is the program, like at the end of Westworld, when you realize that the programs for humans are mm-hmm. less complex than the robots, the program for Rorschach and the comedian was extremely simple. And it, like, he knew exactly where they were going to hit points. You know, obviously to Ozymandias, even in Manhattan was a fairly simple book to read, right? But then particularly is that Rorschach cannot deviate from what, mm-hmm. you know, from his codes, mm-hmm. like that man, or, yeah, the black and white of Mr. A.
I also think it's important to, I think we'll obviously talk about all of them, but I think it's important to remember the reactions of our normal people, of our middlemen, like Night Owl and, or Owlman. Damn it.
Wait. You were right.
I was right. I said Owlman.
Night Owl.
Night Owl and Silk Spectre, who basically were like, well, they're right. Let's go fuck. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they were just like, I think it's interesting to see how, like, everyone's reactions to that was. I think Rorschach being like, nah, this is, nah, fam, I gotta fix this. I'm telling everybody, because this is bad. And the comedian being just like, oh my God, he broke. I think it's an interesting, and then the actual people who don't think on that level, who don't think like the comedian or Rorschach, were just kind of like, you know what, this is above my pay grade, let's go somewhere else. So I find that fascinating. I don't know if that answers your question at all, but I do think that I think Rorschach and the comedian have very different reactions, because I don't know if Eddie ever thought that they were necessarily, I don't know if he thought it was wrong. I just think he just wasn't, he didn't know how to, you know, conceptualize it.
He didn't know if he should be involved in that kind of save
yeah.
the world, or...
Yeah, I don't know if it just kind of broke.
Rorschach or the comedian?
Comedian.
The comedian, yeah. I think Rorschach will, I don't think there's anything that could ever sway Rorschach from his point of view, ever, period. Like, yeah. Even that, like, literally that broke the comedian. Rorschach was like, nah. I know what's right and what's wrong. Like, he never swayed. So, like, I don't think there's anything, if that wasn't going to break him, there's nothing. I don't think there's anything that could have, he just has his own set of moral codes that he is literally, that are just built into him. And mm-hmm. the comedian doesn't have any, so he just, I don't know, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not even sure, I mean, you know, with Rorschach, it's like, is it the killing, or is it just the deception? Or is it, so what is it about what Veidt does that makes Rorschach, like, say, nope, you know.
I thought it was the end of war, no? Was it, like, literal that he finally found the way to end war, period? Was that not it? For me, that was, like... That's it?
Was it the conspiracy? Was it, I mean, that's it. That's the question. Was it the conspiracy? Was it the lies? Was it the fact that he didn't like Veidt? And it's very hard, yeah.
Was he looking up to Mike? Do you think that?
Well, he was going to expose him. I mean, he was leaving that. He was leaving the compound to expose.
Yeah, he was telling everyone. Yeah,
he'd already dropped the book off. It was already going to happen. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think what we can agree is that the comedian is definitely a metaphor for a bunch of different things, but mostly U.S. foreign policy. And Rorschach is awful.
I don't know if we were talking about before Watchmen, but I just read the Rorschach and the comedian version, but the comedian version where it was like with the Kennedys and stuff, it was so bizarre to me, but it was so interesting because it did have such, I thought it was a terrible overall, but I thought it was had a very interesting, what it had to say about how the U.S. wanted to use the Vietnam War as literally, you know, to basically further their financial effort. We all know this, whatever. And you know, the comedian was just like, what? No, this isn't, that's not war. This is war. And he kept, that was just like his, like, and I just thought that was interesting. I didn't like the way it was written or whatever, but I thought that the commentary on the U.S. foreign policy at that time was fascinating, because I'm not, obviously not that familiar with it outside of like the civil rights movement and all that stuff, but I thought that was fascinating.
Well, you have to, okay, so I like, my stepdad was a huge history nerd, so in brief, I'll just go into the sense of manipulation, because I would argue that the manipulation that the United States does in this is very similar to what Biden ended up doing, because they have failed. Because the U.S. is trying to get to a point where I would argue he's trying to get to a point where even he sees that he is, you know, that the world is good, that, you know, like that everything has ended. I think he still wants to get to a point where he's still on top. You know what I mean? And we can talk about that more when we get to him, but I still think he wants to get to a point where, like, he's on top, the company's on top. It's very much capitalist. And historically, the whole thing with the spread of the stop of communism is that you can trace the path from the U.S.'s actions in the Vietnam War through most of our other political engagements all the way to the fact that we ended up, the CIA has continuously involved itself in programs that, you know, would do stuff like train spies and terrorists, you know, from other countries. And when you consider that it's like shooting yourself in the foot, I can see why the comedian wouldn't want to do that. But again, everybody's kind of pawns and big stuff. So perhaps Rorschach, and again, I'm not going to justify him because he's just ridiculous, you know, he's awful. But perhaps Rorschach saw that, you know, when you're pawns of something bigger, people were trying to do things bigger, then you have to do whatever you can to stop it. I don't even know if I'm making sense, guys. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I think I see what you're kind of getting at. It's like, I guess, well, I don't know if I could follow up on it, but you made a good point.
It's okay. Because I could go into a lot of detail about the connection to how shitty the U.S. has been abroad to other countries, especially in regards to trying to, quote-unquote, stop communism. Go in and take all that country's natural resources and everything else. And ultimately how, if you read the book and or watch the movie Charlie Wilson's War, they go into the fact that, you know, the CIA promised to pay people in Afghanistan and money to take out the Russians. And when they didn't pay, you have all of these people who have CIA training that's been passed down through Afghanistan, and suddenly it's like, well, what did you do with it? You know what I mean? And that's directly tied into actual foreign policy that we had. So when you're dealing with a power, you're dealing with somebody who seems to have absolute power. And I still will stand by, and we'll bring it back up when we get bites, I will still stand by the idea that, you know, everybody's reacting to the larger manipulation. That's also what Manhattan is kind of doing. Manhattan is becoming the power that's manipulating people. Manhattan is becoming this seemingly all-powerful thing, and, you know, how do people react within that? And that's my point.
Right. We will talk about Manhattan and Veidt. There are many. That'll probably be a much longer.
Oh, yeah.
they're just bigger philosophical. There's a lot of bigger philosophical conundrums. I mean, also looking at the inspirations for them and what that means. But yeah, from the comedian's perspective, yeah. I mean, he's seen some really bad stuff. He's done really bad stuff. He's the nightmare, right?
Mm-hmm.
They show many times how he, you know, he doesn't really care about who's right or who's wrong. That's not what it is about for him. But yeah, it's too much. Like, I stick by my original thing where it's like, what they think they believe, they're not, they're kind of like, it's a crutch to protect them from feeling pain. And Veidt and Manhattan are actually what they, you know, pretend to be to protect themselves, you know, from feeling pain.
I also find it interesting that we have, you know, Rorschach, who really respects the comedian or whatever in his own way, who but has his worldview of very black and white, and the comedian who is just doesn't see the world. I don't even know what color he sees the world in, but I find that interesting that they always get lined up together or whatever. And I'm not sure, not and lined up, but like, why do we, they get, I mean, are they lumped together just because they're just like the most obvious bad guys or whatever? I don't know.
They're different faces of the right wing. I mean, there's the right wing who's right wing because they can be like, if you, so let's say you're of the elites, you know, you're not, you've maybe come from a not destitute background and you've had some privilege and, you know, you're a white guy in America and you do what you can. Who's going to stop you? I mean, I've got it. I might as well do it. Right. I might as well use the power I've been granted. And then you've got Rorschach, who fervently believes in doctrine, you know, that, like, you know, drugs are a poison and, and, you know, it's sex is ruining America. And, you know, and yes, there's reasons behind why he comes up with these things, but he radically believes. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's it, that they're really the two extremes on that end. Right.
I think it's so hard for me to look at them that way because it's so hard for me to look at Rorschach and the comedian in the vein of like right wing, whatever, right? Because most of the right wingers, white supremacist people that we have access to are all bitches. Like, none of them can take a fight anyway. So it's hard for me, like, these dudes can like fight. And so it's hard for me to like look at the right wing. It works mostly in the shadows. So it's so hard for me to connect the two because. But I get, no, the similarities are so vast and they're there, but it's hard because I'm like, I feel like, it's what the right wing wants to look at themselves as, because they're like, yeah, the badass versions of themselves. Like, you can't reach that, boo-boo. Like, you're not there. So it's hard for me, I guess. That's why I'm like, it's hard for me to make that connection because I always think of that, they kind of flock together in crowds and with pitchforks and, you know, unsuspecting people and Rorschach and comedian will literally bust in on a group of 20 dudes just beating the shit out of people. So it's just like hard for me to see the connection sometimes.
Right. But Rorschach slips back into the shadows. I think that in the show is going to be different, right? I think the show.
Yeah,
the
definitely. Show, yeah. I'm excited for that. Yeah. Cause I think that's what's going to help make that connection.
So did we talk to them before
Watchmen? We talked a little bit about, I brought up a little bit about it for the comedian.
And so, yeah. So, I mean, we could talk about the before Watchmen for the Rorschach. But I was not crazy about it. I felt it was all, I mean, that's, it's, I mean, I think, like, so maybe that's, let's go back and talk about the before Watchmen for Rorschach a little bit, because I feel like the before Watchmen for Rorschach was very, I read it last night for the first time, because I suspected and I had heard that a lot of the before Watchmen's were not good. In the vein of, let's just say in the vein or of the level of Watchmen. And I don't want to, you know, this particular writers, but I felt this one in particular, there was, first of all, the way he talked, I wanted to go in with a marker and block out all the extra words.
Me too. Oh my god, that was me. I was like, wait, nope, too many. I was like an editor. I was like, nope. Like, that was my big, and it set me in a bad mood right from the beginning. I was like, no. Like, anyway, sorry.
It doesn't sound like, exactly. So it was really getting difficult. So that put me off right there. And that said to me, it's just like, you aren't in Rorschach's brain yet.
No,
you need to be in his brain.
Yeah.
And again, it was very much sensationalizing the violence against women, which is part of Rorschach. Yeah. We could talk about Hiroshima Lovers as well, where, you know, everyone sees the Hiroshima Lovers is kind of, it's an artwork that appears throughout the comic. And it's kind of a Rorschach test, right? But I believe it's inspired by when the bomb went off in Hiroshima, everything kind of had a photographic image, you know, in reverse radiation from the bomb, and there, you know, were walls where you could see people's shadows, and this painting, this graffiti that is put up throughout is two people in kind of embracing, and everybody who sees it, it is drawn differently. Like the art is actually different from every panel. And it kind of showed you what their mindset is at the time, and they see a different two things in those. And of course, Rorschach sees it as this dirty, horrible thing, and the picture looks like it's kind of messy. And he's like, it looks like, he's doing something bad to her. She's a prostitute. It's just like, and in his head, he's like, it was probably illicit sexual acts or something like that. And that's what you see in this book, is this kind of like very salacious, we're showing you. And I feel like that's what the romanticized version of Rorschach is that kind of like, it's saving women from themselves kind of thing.
Yeah.
And even he leads on that poor girl at the pie restaurant.
God.
It's just like, and it was never, it was just in like, and you think that like, but he's the one playing her, and it's just.
When are these published? Because that kind of makes me feel like it was like right after New 52, I think. I wonder if they told I don't know if it was DC or WB or whoever pushed this project through, but it kind of sounds like they were, don't be too controversial, even though it's Watchmen. It kind of feels like they.
It was very NC-17.
Yeah, they dead naked women with her everything, like just that's I guess considered not controversial.
Yeah, but. I mean, I'm guessing they didn't want to go like heavy political with it. Like that's what it sounds like, because I don't know who wrote it, but like just knowing
Brian
comic writer.
Yeah, it's Azzarello. Is it
an Azzarello? Azzarello, yeah. I love a lot of Azzarello's stuff. Yeah, I do like a lot of it. My main issue with this one, the Rorschach one, I think was the excessiveness. Like literally the only women that were meant anything in the story were either a potential victim, a victim, or a hooker. Like it was literally like they didn't, none of the women meant they had no value unless it was to take care of him or was to like be grossed out by him or was to be judged by him. And so that was my main issue, but that's like a Rorschach thing in general. That's an issue, but it was like, it felt like the writers had an issue with women too. So that's a problem that I had with it, where I feel like it was hard for me to get through. And I also just didn't, it just felt like it rolled back some of the stuff we already like, he was like, oh, that's my last mistake. And I'm like, but I thought that you became Rorschach with the little girl and the Watcher. Like, it just felt like they were trying to retell his origin story or something, like, aside from what he told the psychiatrist. It just felt unnecessary, I guess.
I can kind of understand it, though, because that's, I feel like Rorschach is the one that has the least amount of, well, this is what happened in the years before Watchmen actually happened. Kind of like, there's not a lot of, I don't know. I mean, I guess you can go into him, but like, if you're not going to hit it at that kind of, this is what he believes really deeply kind of perspective, then you're going to have like, well, here's him beating up criminals and passing
out. Yeah, it stripped a lot of his, what made him, he's a complex character. And I felt like it just simplified him down a little bit too much.
But that's how, I mean, I think that's how people see it. And maybe it's because you read the book once and then you think about it for a long time. The farther you get away from the book, maybe it's easier to kind of take the nuance out of Rorschach. I mean, I think that's the thing that a lot of Alan Moore's work suffers from, is that the really revolutionary stuff like this and V for Vendetta is that the farther you get away, the more you kind of interpret it the way you wanted it to have been, and not necessarily the way it was.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think I have another question, because I had so many questions. Do you think that you should simplify Rorschach, or do you think that what makes him a strong character is the fact that he can be anybody and anybody can kind of put themselves in him?
But he can't. He's Walter Kovacs.
I don't think he should be simplified at all. I think he should be as layered and as complicated as possible. But I think specifically the reason why he's Rorschach is because of his experiences as Walter Kovacs. Like, this apparently there's this new Doomsday Clock version that's obviously got his own set of trauma and weirdness and things that led him to be Rorschach. That's a different version of Rorschach, like I think they each have their own set, but they have to be as complicated. Like the story of Rorschach, whoever is under the mask, or whatever the original mask is, it has to be complicated in general. I don't think it should. But also, I feel like you have to be kind of a messed up person to get to that point in general, versus like picking up the bat cowl and being like, oh, I'm Batman now. Like, that's like a...
Well,
like
they're all messed up though, right?
Well, the Bat Boys, I feel like, are taking on a responsibility to, because that's how they were raised. And we can argue all day about how that's kind of fucked up. And like Bruce Wayne kind of took these damaged kids and made them more damaged, but at least he made them into heroes. Whatever, we can argue about it. But there is, like, we're talking about legacy. We can talk about legacy, but I feel like there's a different... Is the Rorschach legacy something we want to carry on? You know, I don't know. I'd rather have...
I think this is where Alan Moore is kind of like, everybody's like, oh, Alan Moore's just a hater. But come on, it was a work that was in and of itself what he wanted to say. No one else has come close to recreating that, or B, it's always been, even Snyder's movie, which was almost a shot-for-shot recreation, lost
and still
the major points. Yeah.
There was, I remember watching it right after I read it, and I was like, oh man, because the opening sequence was a thing of beauty. I have the whole thing clicked because I plan on gifting it. It is gorgeous. I was like, he got it. Perfect. Beautiful. And then there was just, I kept watching. I was like, there's just so much unnecessary like action. Like, I was like, there's just so many fight scenes in the book. Like, damn. Yeah. It just felt like he wanted it to be an action movie so bad. And I just felt like it was lost in translation to the movie. But the movie was beautiful. Gorgeous.
When I saw Watchmen the movie, and then I saw Batman or Superman, I was under the impression, because it's still not an ideal adaptation, and there was like the fight and everything in the movie, I was under the impression that trying to adapt Watchmen kind of drove Zack Snyder crazy, and he was like, oh, now I have to talk about gods and superheroes all the time in my movies, which is why it's all about Superman. And suddenly Superman is this complicated godlike figure who's written like, you know, him trying to write an Alan Moore Superman. But he couldn't write an Alan Moore Superman because Alan Moore understood, like Wendy said, and granted I haven't read What Happened to Man of Tomorrow, but I trust in the comics, Alan Moore wrote Superman as
a nice And character. Alan Moore is a writer, like a really good writer. It's hard to take something else and just be like, I'm going to do this now against... decades of like an established more concept of Superman. I think Zack Snyder, you have a really good point, Carolyn, because like I didn't think about it like that, but yeah, that's interesting.
Well, remember he also did 300, right? So it's
the which is so good,
super macho. I mean, it is, but yeah,
he did like
that,
I don't know what it was.
Frank Miller.
Frank Miller, he sucks. I love him. I love to hate him, hate to love him. Frank Miller, man.
I think we should just let Zack Snyder do Frank Miller movies.
Right? I think they're great.
But you know, the only thing missing from that movie was the excessive nudity from the book. Right?
Oh my god! Right?
I remember buying the hardcover, and I hadn't remembered it. Like I had read it, and I hadn't remembered it. My dad was really into Greek history, so this was many years ago. So I bought him the book, and then it's Christmas morning, and you're looking at the book, and you're like there's a lot of genitalia. That was an aggression. But yeah, so that story is like the epitome of that kind of toxic masculinity.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, that the comedian, you know, represents, that he's trying to make Batman and Superman represent, which just, that doesn't work.
It was really hard, like, to watch. Yeah, it's hard to watch, like, because one of the reasons why I love Superman so much is because he's like the antithesis of like toxic masculinity. He's literally like, I'm precious and cuddly, and like, I just, it was so bizarre. I was like, this is armored Superman. Is this the guy who came back from the dead? Like, it was so interesting to me. I was like, but let's work with it. I can work with this. Let's see where it's going. And it went nowhere. So anyway,
sorry. Hey, we're gonna get the cut now. Apparently.
So. Oh my god.
Oh my god.
Oh boy, just lit a fucking fire. Like,
I got into a fight with a Snyder Twitter people one time,
they're really intense.
Yeah, I mean, I don't blame him, I guess. I just, you know, save Swamp Thing too, so I get it.
I mean, yeah.
These are the characters that are so influenced by Alan Moore's work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to see how many people were affected by it and how many people, you know, identified with the negative characters, Rorschach and Speedy, and how that even translates to how they see positive characters. Because I really do maintain that, like, you can't write Superman from the perspective of thinking of him as a god. You can't think of Rorschach as a heroic character, and you can't think of the comedian as a heroic character. I've said it before, I'll say it again. The comedian is like if Captain America went crazy. And the and that's the whole point of his character, and the whole point of Rorschach's character is, like, you know, the negative influences of this. And it's very interesting that this is what men, what this heterosexual men have drawn from this, largely. Like, you ask a lot of big comic book writers, influential comics they read, and it's Watchmen. And it's like, you really have to wonder how much Rorschach and the comedian and them trying to deconstruct the story, and how much people didn't get it, and how Alan, it was written by a guy, it was written by Alan Moore, who's this guy who's openly, I mean, he supported the LGBT movement, he was in a polygamous relationship, openly called himself anarchist, and how all these people just keep, you know, getting it wrong, which is why, you know, because I will segue it back to the show, because we could go on for hours, you guys. Wendy, Tony, and Vanessa and I are just, we're fun.
Wait, yeah, it's, bring an energy drink when we talk about Ozymandias and
that. Oh, yeah. It's going to be at least a 3-hour podcast.
It's my favorite.
What I want to say is that it brings it back to the show, because first time, Damon Lindelof, everybody else, are including opinions of people of color. They're including the opinions in the writing of people who are have different backgrounds besides a straight, cis, heterosexual white male. So the final question that I want to pose before I let Wendy wrap it up is, do you guys think that through the eyes of people who aren't straight, cis, heterosexual white men, the characters will be interpreted differently?
No. I don't think so. I think they'll be interpreted differently. Yes. Will they lose their coreness? No. I think these guys are speaking as a woman of color. These guys are these men are our boogeymen. The comedian Rorschach's those are my boogeymen. Those are white guys who, even if they got caught, they don't get shot. they get sent to prisons, you know, and then they get out and they survive somehow. They're like cockroaches. And then their ideals spread. So I think as a woman of color who is a writer as well, if I was writing the show, I'd nail it down pretty well. And I'd also be very, very clear as to why these dudes aren't heroes. And anyone who does identify, and there will be people who still identify with them after the show airs, make no mistake. But I want the show to at least be very clear that anyone who identifies with these characters, and that these characters are bad people, period. Mm-hmm. Like, there's bad people, there's shades of gray, that people do bad things for good reasons, but there's bad people and there's people who, you know, specifically want a group of people to not exist anymore, kind of bad people. So I personally don't think that, like, the core essence of the characters will change at all. But I do think that they'll probably be presented as a lot scarier than they have been in any live action, you know, medium.
Awesome. Yeah, I think I think because, like, in universe, they're going to be like historical figures versus, like, a consumer kind of reacting to them, I do think you're going to have more, like, because I guess I feel like in the comic, like, Rorschach was just kind of, okay, this is that guy who might come and beat you up if you're in the wrong place or something like that. But I do think that you're going to have more detailed, like, well, this is who he was, and this is why he was kind of monstrous. Maybe you shouldn't, you know, look up to him. We do know that there are people who look up to him, but
yeah, and they always will. Yeah.
So I'm glad they're going to address it at least. But
I hope they do a better job of it than a certain CW show that spent way too much time sympathizing white supremacists, or I'm sorry, alien supremacists, human supremacists. Like, no shade, but like, let's be real. Let's not spend too much time humanizing people who want other people to die for just for existing. Anyway. Yeah,
it might happen, but I think it's been 35 years, right? I mean, let's be honest, this is not the same country. I think it's for worse and for worse, really. the representation of what the comedian was is now probably being replaced by, you know, the police and masks, and I'm assuming that the representation of what Rorschach was is being replaced by the Rorschachs. And Rorschach really in 35 years, you know, I don't think that Rorschach caused anything to happen, but he has been adopted as a persona by a lot of people willing to do a lot of harm, you know, in ways they might not even know that they're emulating Rorschach, but they're emulating someone who was emulating Rorschach. But it's kind of led to that thing, you know, the trench coat conspiracy. And maybe, you know, you might be able to tie it back to the question, definitely to Mr. A, although he wasn't really widely read. I mean, that was an underground comic. But I think, you know, it's really that kind of like, oh, you know, I'm going to be Rorschach. I'm going to get justice for my people or whatever. And that's a reality, a dangerous reality that we have to face now, where it was kind of like the conspiracy theorist and, you know, sitting alone in a room with some string watching Unsolved Mysteries, right? Now it's everybody, and they're not hiding anymore. So it's become a very different world. And I think we need something like this, not to deconstruct superheroes, but to give us a mirror to hold up on what's become of these tropes from Watchmen, since Watchmen happened. Not even, you know, so now it's kind of like, are we deconstructing Watchmen? Is what I'm guessing. Is what
I mean, why not? I was literally going to say, like, I think the thing is, like, as someone who is a woman of color, like, there are things that Rorschach did while I was reading The Watchmen. I'm like, all right, you know, I get it. Like, yeah, would I murder a child murderer? I don't think I would. I'm not just saying, like, 90% sure I wouldn't. But am I mad that he did that? No, I'm not mad about it. So there's things I think that are relatable to Rorschach that are scary. But I also think we need to, like, think about that as a whole. Like, just because we understand little bits and pieces of the comedian too, doesn't mean that as the whole, I think people conflate that with, okay, I agree with some parts of this. So I think that that means he's great. And I love that. You know what I mean? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah. And that's the slippery slope though, isn't it? It's like, well, you can identify, and you can, I mean, you know, you can empathize with even the most horrible of, you know, people. That doesn't make what they did societally okay. but you don't want to go down that slippery slope where it's like, well, yeah, you know, I can, you can't, you, there's a difference between understanding and saying it's, you know, publicly acceptable. Okay. All right, guys, so next podcast we're going to be talking about Night Owl and Silk Spectre, and I think we'll include both Silk Spectres and both Night Owls, as they are both legacy heroes. And of course, as part of that, we'll also be talking about all three Blue Beetles. Maybe a little bit of Black Canary.
Yeah,
and Nightshade.
Yeah, I like Suicide Squad too. That was...
You had me at Black Canary.
Not the movie, maybe. But... I didn't watch the movie.
You didn't?
No.
I think she's been in Justice League Dark recently. All right, so that we'll talk about next week. So until then, you can email us if there's stuff that you thought we got wrong or that you didn't like what we said. Go ahead and email us at watchmantvpodcast@gmail.com. You can post a comment on our website, watchmanpodcast.com. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can call us at 918-200-9103. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at Watchmen Podcast. And on Twitter, you can find us at Watchmen Talk. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher Radio. And we always love it when you give us a rating and review and let us know how we're doing. Watchmen Podcast is part of the DC TV Podcast Network. So if you are interested in other DC TV shows, you can check us out at Batwoman Podcast, Black Lightning Podcast, DC TV Classics, DC's Legends of Tomorrow Podcast, iZombie Radio, Krypton Podcast, Stargirl Podcast, Supergirl Radio, Swamp Thing Radio, and The Flash Podcast. You can subscribe to DC TV Podcast on Apple Podcasts and follow DC TV Podcast on Twitter and like DC TV Podcast on Facebook. Until next time, tick tock, tick tock. We need a better sign out.